Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast. Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is very exciting because it's the first time we've done a live podcast. My name is David Jones, and I work with my colleague, Naomi Murphy. And Naomi is going to say something just about the podcast.
Hi there, everyone. Thanks very much for inviting us along today. It is really exciting, as David has said. So David and I started the Locked Up Living podcast out of a conversation where we were discussing how harsh some institutional settings could be and our reflections on how innovative, change-oriented organisations and individuals within them find ways to withstand pressures to conform to prevailing cultures that might feel quite harsh or even toxic. We also both recognise there's a tendency towards silo thinking within the criminal justice system and really wanted to bring together diverse voices that had a lot of potential to learn from another. So initially we were discussing trying to take over an edition of a journal to create space for like-minded individuals to share their reflections on these themes, when a journalist friend of David's suggested we start a podcast. And perhaps because working in forensic institutions means you have to be up for a challenge, we both decided this would be a great initiative to experiment with. So we've spent the past year creating conversations with an amazing group of kind, compassionate, free-thinking individuals that are passionate about providing a meaningful contribution to society and trying to create different ways of thinking about life in harsh organisations in order to make them less aversive and to make their contribution to society more valuable. During this year, we've had conversations with a number of leading criminologists, side professionals and researchers, as well as people with lived experience and activists. We've covered a diverse range of topics such as emotional literacy in the criminal justice system, restorative justice, prison food, being a parent or not being a parent whilst in prison, the value of arts and the importance of factors such as language and hope in enabling desistance. And this week we've reached over 5,000 downloads, which isn't bad for two people who had few technical skills when we started this venture as a hobby. So thanks very much for inviting us along.
Thank you, Naomi. So of course, the whole purpose of us being here today is to focus upon enabling environments and Sarah Padgett and the work that she's done. So we get straight into it. Sarah is currently the program manager for a range of quality networks at the Royal College of Psychiatrists Centre for Quality Improvement. She has held this post for 17 years and has overseen major developments, not just in therapeutic communities, which was the original focus, but in bringing on quite distinct developments such as enabling environments. The work involves the engagement with services and activities in such a way that leads to improvement or systemic change in a range of services for adults, children, young people across the NHS, voluntary, private, independent, education, and of course the criminal justice sectors. And Sarah, it's true to say, I think specialises in working with services to improve the quality of the psychosocial environment. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, David. Hi, Naomi.
Hi, Sarah. Really, really excited to have you on today. I mean, you spent such a long time working in this current role, and I know that you're about to make a major change in your working life. So it seems important to capture something of your reflections on the past 17 years. I wondered if you could tell us something about yourself and how you came to be working for the Royal College of Psychiatry.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for asking me to do this. And thanks to everyone who's listening to it. It is a privilege, but it is excruciating. And having listened to everybody talking about the work that they're doing, I feel very humble and wonder why on earth anybody would want to listen to what I've got to say. But I suppose when I think about what brought me to the college, I have to go back quite a long way, really. And I thought that, and even probably before my first job. So I suppose what I wanted to say was that I grew up in Wales. I think it's an important factor in my life that I grew up within a small community, in fact, a very small community, basically lived in the middle of nowhere where my sister literally married the boy next door who lived a mile and a half away. But my world was entirely the local school, village school, and a Baptist chapel. And so I was inspired by, I suppose, that sort of Welsh passion, I guess. But having English parents, it also felt that I was sort of slightly out of sync or slightly didn't quite belong. We were also on the sort of borderlands, sort of in Wales. And so I was neither so entirely in Wales, but nor was I entirely in England. So I consistently had this this sense of people saying, "Oh, yeah, but that's not really Wales, is it? You know, where we lived," which this whole kind of sense of where do I belong, I think, is very key in my decisions. I think that probably one of the most influential moments in my life was going to a sort of large school, you know, going to big school, so to speak, which was a horrifying, and I found probably the most toxic environment of my life. And in the words of Terry Pratchett's Rincewind, I felt very much like a pickled onion in a fruit salad, and just didn't feel that I belonged particularly. But I left school so quite early at 16, sort of feeling like I couldn't really reach my potential in that environment. And I think this has become a theme, which is why I've decided to sort of mention it. Despite everything and despite all of my instinct otherwise, I have to admit that probably one of my greatest influences at that time was Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was devastating the Welsh valleys at the time that I was growing up, and the miners' strike and the destruction of industry and communities without any thought or consideration to the people involved just was horrifying. I've used that word twice now. But and my family still are suffering in some ways, some of my family still having an impact on that. And certainly many of these valley communities have never survived and never got over it, really. But I suppose from there, you know, I went into nursing. And I definitely found a place in nursing. I grew up in nursing in a large asylum in South Wales, And again, you know, the impact of Thatcher's policies around the sort of fundamental and sort of ideological shift from institutional care to community care, again, sort of drove this idea that somehow people, communities were just being destroyed without any sense or thought about the impact on the individuals involved. You know, but those large asylums were not necessarily good places. You know, terrible things happened there. I witnessed some most awful treatment of people. But on the other hand, there was something wonderful about them too, that I think people forget, that the community element that existed in those environments, the sense of belonging that people who otherwise didn't belong felt in those communities. And many of the staff that worked there, their whole families worked there, their lives were entwined with the lives of people who were very severely unwell, people who you would not see now because of the advances in treatments for people with mental health problems. But they were accepted and they were part of the local community, and you'd bump into people in the pub that you were nursing, and they were very much part of the community. And the asylum for many provided literally a sanctuary, an asylum from the world that where they didn't belong. So I, during that time, I was introduced to R.D. Lang and the therapeutic community approach and the therapeutic community proper, and was inspired by those ideas, which essentially has sort of driven me on. I left nursing, I went to university, and then I was lucky enough to find a job working for the, what's called the Fellowship Charitable Foundation, Ellie Jansen of Richmond Fellowship fame or notoriety, was the CEO at the time. And I became the therapy deputy manager and then manager of a therapeutic community in Eastbourne, working with people with severe and enduring mental health problems, many of whom were high risk and were not able to live without some form of support. And we ran a therapeutic community where people could move from the idea of, at that time, the idea of people being dependent on the system was considered to be everything that's bad about this, about the health system at the time. Whereas I instinctively believed that people needed to belong before they could become not independent, but interdependent. And what you needed with many of the people we were working with was to build up, or in some ways kind of almost, as Rex Haig would say, a sort of form of secondary development, to develop sort of a basic trust which had not been there or wasn't there. And without that, people don't turn up for appointments at the hospital, they don't turn up for appointments with their social worker or their probation officer or whoever it might be. And so the idea of the therapeutic community was that people were dependent upon the community and on the environment, and that a skilled practitioners can move them from that place to a more interdependence. Yeah. So, and then I came across the community of communities. I came across the therapeutic community world, the Association of Therapeutic Communities, the Windsor Conference, you know, all of the people in the therapeutic community world. And Rex Haig and others, and including myself, were involved in setting up the community of communities and developing the standards. I was the first therapeutic community manager to look at a set of standards and apply them to my community. There we are. Fortunately, over time, Sarah Tucker became the manager of community of communities. And when she left, Adrian Worrell asked me if I would take her role, and that's what I did. So that's what's brought me to the Royal College. Rather long-winded, but there we are.
No, that was, I found that really interesting to hear that, Sarah. I suppose what was particularly striking was how that theme of community has been, and on the opposite side of that sense of not quite belonging, how those two themes have been so present throughout your life and drawing on your experiences and making meaning from that and learning and being able to, I guess, empathize with people and have some understanding of what they need. As you know, really struck by you talking about people's need to be able to belong in order to then experience interdependence, to move on to being independent. And remember training in the early 90s, where there was this horror of this fear that if you did anything more than 6 months worth of work, you might end up encouraging somebody to be dependent on you, which would be awful. But of course, when you've got people with very complex histories who have no experience of being able to rely or be dependent on people, that actually they need that experience of dependence in order to be able to grow and be independent, don't they? So it's fascinating to hear that. What was the underlying rationale for the enabling environments when that started? What was the point of the project?
Well, I suppose it's difficult to, sort of thinking about the community of communities in the first instance, because the community of communities was set up by the by Rex and managed by Sarah as part of the again a kind of huge shift in health culture towards what was called the modernization agenda. And the idea being is that TCs just wouldn't survive this new world. And there needed to be a way that therapeutic communities and their could sit in this new world. And community of communities was set up as a bridge to that, as a way of almost translating what happened in the community into a language that the new commissioning agenda that was coming in at the time could understand and fund, essentially. So the fear was that the therapeutic communities, sort of inward looking, sort of known as the navel gazing of the therapeutic community, and you know, these communities needed to do that to some extent in order to provide the containment that they did for people, very damaged individuals that used health therapeutic communities at the time, to be able to be understood by the wider world, and that standards were suggested as, and in the end, adopted as a way of doing that. So that process, I mean, you know, that journey was enormous before we even came to enabling environments. You know, we did a whole load of work with commissioners to look at how some of the large therapeutic communities could survive. Nick Benefield was very much instrumental, that we heard earlier, and Rex in creating the personality disorder, no longer a diagnosis of exclusion. The idea that somehow, and there was a number of pilot sites that were funded across the country, developing new therapeutic communities. But still, there was this real threat to especially the residential therapeutic communities at the time. The continuation of that work plus led, and at the same, almost at the same time, developing the prison audits for therapeutic communities, which we might want to speak about a bit later on or not. But that work was very important in terms of the development of the therapeutic community principles in those settings, and bringing them into the community of communities, which helped people to recognize that they weren't the only therapeutic communities, and that they did have a shared sibling. They had siblings that they could share with. The enabling environments came much later, sitting at the heart of community of communities. I received many contact with people. We got a national lottery grant, some people may remember, for rather a lot of money to develop the standards for other therapeutic communities in learning disability, addictions and children's settings. And it was this that sort of get the kind of birth of enabling environments was very much in that, probably within the learning disability communities more than anywhere, where there was this sense that these were not therapeutic communities proper. You know, David Kennard talked about the therapeutic community approach, but they weren't even therapeutic community approach. It was something around a set of values that were about living together and about sharing and about creating environments that enabled people to thrive and to develop. And I worked with a number of L'Arche and Camp Hill communities, most of which virtually none of the Camp Hills now exist. And then also being called by people wanting to join communities but not wanting to be a therapeutic community. And also myself thinking, well, therapeutic communities are not right for everybody. You know, there are many environments, there are many places like schools. I mean, I'm not talking about schools that are special schools for people, or I'm not talking about mental health or prison environments. I mean, just any environment. We all need enabling environments to thrive. Maybe I was thinking about myself. Maybe I was thinking about that school experience, but I wasn't conscious of that, certainly not at the time. But the idea of enabling environments came up at a conference over a bottle of red wine with Tom Harrison, who had written about the Northfield experiments, which many people will know of in relation to the first therapeutic communities in the Second World War. And he talked to me about, he was a social psychiatrist, and he talked to me about his landladies and how many people with very severe and enduring mental health problems were coming out of these large asylums and going into guest houses with landladies who ran them in the most magnificent way by just being a friend, but a friend with very clear boundaries about what was and what wasn't acceptable. And the enabling environments was born out of that. And Rex, and I mentioned earlier, Rex and Tom Harrison, Susan Williams, Kirk Turner, Robin Johnson, Adrian Worrell, and myself set up a development group, and I'm not sure who came up with the term enabling environments, but it sort of morphed and into that, and that's what it became. We piloted it as a way of championing ordinariness, a way of saying that, you know, you don't have to be a professionally qualified, you don't have to be a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a nurse or any of these people with letters after their name. You just need to be able to be with another person in a genuine, authentic, meaningful relationship, and creating the environment and the structures to enable that to be safe is all part of doing that. And some people do it naturally, and as these landladies did.
I really liked that phrase you used, championing ordinariness, because I think what I'm hearing you talk about is really quite a lot of innovation in terms of thinking, but being combined with a sense of pragmatism and trying to be pragmatic about where you might create these opportunities that could enable people to flourish and really maximize small opportunities like school or ordinary kind of environments, and recognizing that a full-on TC doesn't have to be the way to do that. But I wondered, so that you're bringing this kind of like real sense of innovative thinking into this post and the project, I wondered, has the project and role changed over time? Has there been scope for that innovative thinking to evolve and develop over time, or have things remained more static than that?
Oh, I mean, it's changed beyond words. I mean, it's when I started at the college, it was the college research unit. Very different college at that time. That was 2004. Well, I first started at the college, I suppose, in 2002, because I was on the advisory group, which for the Community of Communities for the first couple of years. And then I became the manager in 2004. We only had 37 members when I joined the Community of Communities. And we had a small set of standards and a peer review process. And I had an administrator who worked sort of half time. So I was a project manager, but I was absolutely everything. Yeah, the project manager, I did all the project officer role and everything. So I just had one half a person who helped me do all of this. But then over time, we gradually increased in membership. We got a contract to work, as I said, with the commissioners to develop something we called the Five Fives, which was a set of standards that commissioners could use to establish whether a therapeutic community in the National Health Service met certain agreed conditions around risk and various other issues that therapeutic community people felt were antithetical to their work. And it was a really difficult role, actually. I was seen as someone who was sort of dragging therapeutic communities into, you know, into this sort of tick box sort of modernized, you know, system. Similarly with the prison audits, I was asked to look at this the new model that had been developed for therapeutic communities in prisons and create a set of standards out of them. And I thought, oh, they're a manual, that'll be fine. And it was like 20, you know, they're huge sets of manuals that I had to look through and match with the CFC standards, and eventually managed to get another member of staff to help me with all of this. And but again, you know, it wasn't considered to be a very positive thing. I mean, I remember somebody once saying to me when I went to visit a therapeutic community that, you know, we spent 50 years trying to get away from the psychiatry and you're dragging us right back into it, you know. And I just remember thinking, like, I'm just trying to help. I had no idea about the history. I had no idea about, you know, the sense of the fear, actually, the fear of losing something creative. I mean, TCs are very anarchic, very radical. You know, how can you be anarchic and radical with a set of standards, you know? But then, like I said, we had the lottery grant, and then I ended up with more staff than I knew what to do with, developing four sets of standards. And then out of that came the enabling environments. then the enabling environments, you know, Nick Benefield turns up one day and says, you know, we love the idea of the enabling environments. How about, you know, having a national enabling environments in prisons and probation program, you know? So, and then, you know, that sort of took off, and now the probation service, the approved premises are very much committed and working with us on a contract. It's been a massive change. And in amongst all of that, you know, obviously my organization was changing. So this is all obviously happening mm-hmm. with the project, but my organization was changing around me in ways that were incredibly difficult, you know, from being able to have that creative spirit and support to develop all these new, this new work. There were new structures that came with that, that made that a bit more difficult. And also my role changed. And interestingly, I ended up managing two other projects, which took me right back to where I'd been in my first, my early life, and managing quality networks for mental health rehabilitation and older age mental health, which is where I started. So yes, the role has changed.
Thank you. And you referred to, which I'm glad you brought it up, so I don't have to make myself unpopular, but you referred to the conservatism of the RCP, and when combined with the more sort of radically innovative approach of therapeutic communities. And I wondered, has that created tensions over time, you know, or is it, or have there been advantages to having this kind of like combination of partners that might balance itself out in some way?
Well, I don't know, actually. I was avidly looking earlier at who was listening to me speaking, and I've stopped looking, so I don't know who is listening now. But I am sure that if there is anybody that's from the actual college, they will know that the creative tension, it does exist, and I'm very vocal about that. However, I think they will know, and I think the reality is that tension reflects the real world. And I think there was something about being situated at the Royal College of Psychiatrists that really challenges you to communicate what we do in a way that people who aren't familiar with therapeutic communities, are not familiar with relational practice, aren't familiar with the way we speak. And I think from that point of view, it's really helpful to be in an environment that is, I mean, just recently we had a situation that arose that was very frustrating for all parties, actually. And our strategic communications department were wanting, what is an enabling environment, you know, and how, but exactly what is it? And it was like the struggle to try and say, exactly what is it? I'm still not sure, because it's almost an instinctive thing. It's almost like, well, it's like, I was talking to somebody the other day, it's almost like trying to explain like a religious faith, you know. It's like, well, why do you believe this thing is right, you know? It's really difficult. So I think being at the college, it you know, really does exactly what we the original intention, which was to somehow or another provide a home that enables us to communicate what therapeutic communities are and what enabling environments are to a world that maybe otherwise might not understand it. Yeah, I think that ultimately, you know, psychiatry, you know, I have to say, that on the whole, it feels, and at times feels, that psychiatry doesn't seem to value the kind of relational elements of the work. It's not at the forefront of training, it's not at the forefront of treatment necessarily. But the reality is that the vast majority of psychiatrists I meet know these things are important. You know, the popularity and success of Intelligent Kindness, you know, written by Penelope Campling and John Ballard, you know, and the interest in that, and sessions that we've done for psychiatrists. I think nobody comes into the job to tick boxes. You know, nobody comes into the job to, you know, to fill out metrics and be performance and performance manage. You know, everybody comes into the job because they feel like they want to do a good job. And I think it's up to you know, up to, I was going to say up to me, you know, there you go, that just says something, doesn't it? It's not up to me, it's up to us, or it's up to, I feel there's a sense that enabling environments can support organisations to prioritise these elements of the work. And I think that it is possible to prioritise the culture of the environment whilst still focusing on those other elements.
Thank you.
Just picking up a couple of things that you mentioned there, Sarah, I have to say I've worked with loads and loads of psychiatrists, many of whom have been really great people who've contributed a lot. Others haven't been quite so worthwhile working with, but seems to depend upon the individual greatly. Just to say something else as well, I think you gave a terrific description of, I was going to say metamorphosis. I'd actually written down metamorphosis, but I think it's really evolution, you know, the evolution of some ideas into the work that is a therapeutic community, that is the work of an enabling environment. And I think that coming with that evolution, there are differences and there are competitiveness and there's rivalry, and all of that has to be worked with and contained within the, well, to use a slightly overworked phrase, you know, the great family of the Royal College under your auspices. So I was going to ask you what is an enabling environment, but you've just said that you don't know. So if you have any ideas towards the end, you can tell us. But I'm interested in knowing what it was like for you doing this job. What was it like? What were the places that you were working with? Did you ever go to any of them? Did you ever see, or was it all done at a distance?
Oh no, I've spent half my life on trains and in therapeutic communities and enabling environments and various different places all over the place. I mean, over the last few years, less so. I think I recognise that the best place I could sit would be, you know, facilitate other people to be doing that work. It's probably what's the reason why I'm actually leaving, in the sense that I would like to have a little bit of that back, actually. And you know, you can't do both well. But yes, I have some incredible experiences of having visited places. I think there are a few, you know, that sort of come to mind and that I've sort of noted down and to sort of comment on. And I suppose one of them is about the value of the peer review process. So on Community of Communities, we run a peer review process, which we would like to do on enabling environments at some point. But I think, so the idea behind the peer review process is that staff and service users from therapeutic communities would visit other therapeutic communities to review, well, not to review them against the standards, because the service would review themselves against the standards, but the peer review process was about ratifying that and to say, yes, we agree with you that you meet that, or yes, you know. And I think it was about the value of the kind of service user involvement. Now, this has become more problematic over time because of sort of DBS and various other bits and pieces. But it's the bit that I think I feel saddest about, the biggest change that's happened, because the value of and these would be people, patients, service users, clients, whatever language you use, who are in treatment, who are in a community, that would go with the staff member to visit another service. And I can remember being on a prison visit, and Kirk Turner, if he's still with us, will remember this absolutely. We were sitting in this room, and the prison sitting there trying to give us this picture that this community was meeting every standard, but the men were doing their usual sort of everything is rubbish and you're all shit and the staff are crap and, you know, the usual sort of situation, and moaning about absolutely everything from the food to the, and you know, they each had their own cell, and at that time they could smoke and there was various other bits. And this one service, you know, one of the the experts by experience or the service users, she could just see her getting agitated. And eventually she turned around and she said, "Oh, for fuck's sake, shut up. Stop whinging. You don't know you're born. You know, I'm in a TC and I can only go there during the day. I go home to a bed sit. I can barely afford the heating. I've got no food. I can't smoke." And she just really challenged them and it changed the whole day. And suddenly there was a much more reflective kind of process of an understanding and a connection that developed, which allowed sort of genuine and authentic kind of dialogue about the nature of these two services and the experiences that they had. So I think that's one thing that I don't think I'll ever forget. Another one I think I would choose, which for me it says something about and speaks to the people who are listening, who work in prison settings, especially secure, high secure prisons, but also actually not especially prison, I think in probation too. My first visit to a non-therapeutic community prison was a large category A jail. And I say large, it's like over 1,000 men. And I was asked to go there because the governor, Paddy Fox, had been speaking to Nick Benefield. This was a sort of all part of the sort of beginning of the National Enabling Environments program. And we've been talking, Rex and Nick and I and Adrian Worrell and others, about the idea that what we want to do is recreate a sort of pride in prisons, you know, that sort of the prison, the idea of enabling environments championing ordinariness, and that, you know, one of the things that we were recognizing was sort of the importance of good jailcraft, as it's often called, you know. And some people instinctively are able to de-escalate situations and be relational without losing boundaries, without losing. I think time, I don't know if anybody's watched the drama on television, you know, Time, you can see sort of snippets of that, a brilliant portrayal of a sort of the toxicity of a jail. I think that I went there and I spent quite a good period of time, but the first time I went there for 2 days. And when I went, I was accompanied around the prison by a person whose job it was to show me everything, to show me the whole place and, you know, warts and all. And one particular wing wanted to sort of go for the enabling environment ward, and they were so enthusiastic. The two people who were leading on it were just so passionate about it and desperately wanting to engage with me and so proud of what they were doing, and rightly so in the environment that they were in. But I remember going back to the hotel and just crying all night. I couldn't even go out for something to eat. I just wept from the moment I got there to the moment I went to sleep, and then went back in the following day and then got the train home and fell into my husband's arms and wept again. And he said, "What on earth is wrong with you?" You know, and I said, "Yeah, I just don't know what's wrong with me." But during that time, I'd been talking to a woman who was a prison officer, very hard, very defended, and there had been a terrible murder on a wing that she'd been involved. She'd been there, she'd found the person, and she'd also had to accompany the parents of that person who'd been killed actually by two people, and to show them where he died. And she was telling me about this with no emotion at all. In fact, far from it. You know, when I asked her how she felt, she said, "You know, he deserved it," or something of that nature, you know, good enough for him, or best thing to happen, or something, you know, very defended. And there was a lot of that as I was going around, this sort of sense of, you know, it's all fine. And, you know, and this woman, it turned out, she just looked so sad and so but was so angry. And I found myself feeling overwhelmed by that sense of desperation and the hopelessness of the place and the just desolate, the lack of all hope, I suppose. And I just felt that there was there has to be something we do about this. There has to be something that we can. And how do these people work here, let alone live here, you know? So I think that experience really, really made me passionate about the enabling environments work and it not being, I'm going to use the word corrupted. That's not really the right word, but it's still a word I'd like to use, but corrupted by over-professionalism. There's a real challenge to the enabling environment standards that they become professionalized or somehow, you know, sort of made something that is a bit more distant and a bit more, not for the likes of me to understand that sort of thing, you know, but what I was passionate about was those people working on those wings, actually, you know, speaking to people and, you know, followed by a complete reverse experience of visiting a jail and being shown around very large, another large private jail, and being shown around by an individual who was managing by wandering about, completely different, equally difficult prisoners. But this guy would walk around, he knew people's names, he would speak to them, he would recognize people, he would ask them how their grandchildren were. They all knew who he was. And there was this, he was like this walking enabling environment, you know, sort of walking around and really relating to people. And you could feel that when he spoke to someone, they genuinely felt that they mattered to him, you know, and they did, you know, they mattered. And so the contradiction between the two and the simplicity of this guy's approach and the need for something very simple to support a change in those difficult environments.
So picking up this idea of contradiction that you just mentioned, it seems to me that wherever you go, be it into an A category prison or a B category prison or an approved hostel, what you're facing, what you're going to be encountering is, and it will be contained within the organisation and within each individual within that organization, is the conflict between security, anxiety, fear of exposure and humiliation, as against the desire to be supportive and rehabilitative and enabling, really. How did you and you as an organization manage that?
Say that again. Well,
I suppose, were you aware of that? Were you aware of that kind of conflict which must lie within each individual and each organisation? The desire to be helpful, but the anxiety about things going wrong, being exposed, being humiliated.
Yes. Yes, yes, absolutely. Very aware of it. I mean, having come from a clinical background, you know, and having run a therapeutic community and managed reflective groups and, you know, being part of, you know, so it was not that I was, you know, I had an understanding of how perhaps these units could use the standards and use other frameworks to provide some form of containment for that. Because I think what happens, certainly our experience at the college, is often that we are on the other end of a lot of the unprocessed projections from some of our members. And that needs some understanding just from a distant perspective. You know, I think it's very easy. What we find in the criminal justice sector is that it's very easy for it to be about everybody else. Because of course, how much more can you take on yourself, you know? So yes, I think there is, I think my biggest surprise in starting to work with the prison service and in probation was the lack of reflective space, the lack of either you know, on a one-to-one basis or a group, but the lack of a space to think about how the work impacts on you and how that in turn is communicated to other people. You know, so I think, yes, I was very aware of it. But one of the things that, you know, you have to be aware of the boundaries of your role. And of course, going into environments, we're invited to support the service, to develop their service as an enabling environment. Of course, one of the biggest problems with that is that working at service level, it's the organization that creates the culture. And what you really need to be doing is working at a very senior, at an organizational level, to ensure that, you know, the culture, that it is expected that everyone gets the support that they need to manage these incredibly difficult situations, these incredibly difficult feelings that are going to come to the fore. What tends to happen is you end up, and I've seen this in therapeutic communities and I've seen this everywhere, is that you end up with leaders who take this on themselves and contain it all. As the charismatic leader that goes in and saves the world, you know, that can contain everything and can protect everyone, not just from, you know, their own demons or the fears, but also protect them from the organization that they're working within. And then what happens to those individuals? Very often there's people become very sick. Yeah, so.
Thank you, Sarah. That's a great answer. And here's what happened. We're beginning to get close to time, and I know Naomi has got some more key questions to put to you.
Well, just a couple, really. So we recently interviewed David Boyle, author of Tick Box, who writes about some of the problems posed to quality by implementing a prescriptive set of tick box criteria. And I think this might also link with Terry Wilson's point that he's made in the chat about contract culture. So do you think that having a prescriptive set of criteria has perhaps posed any challenges to the EE attempt to provide quality assurance via a list of specified standards? You know, I'm just thinking about some of, we've all read about the great CQC inspections of places, which then subsequently get exposed as being hives of abusiveness within residential places. Do you think EE runs the risk of allowing services to present in one way, but the point to the you know, that desire for real quality and belonging to get lost within it?
It's a great question. And the reason it's a great question is because it highlights the myth that there are prescriptive criteria. There are no prescriptive criteria. And this is the problem. One of the problems we find, especially in the criminal justice, although increasingly it's happening in health as well, is that people, I don't know whether or not it's that they expect or whether they want a tick box, but the fact is enabling environments is not a tick box exercise and it's not prescriptive. And we're very clear that, you know, what we're trying to do is to create a sense of belonging. So the very first value or standard is about belonging. The nature and the quality of relationships are of primary importance. Now, what are we looking for there? How do you provide evidence for that? So what the criteria do is to just highlight a few things. You know, there are ways of marking people leaving. It's an example of something that if you didn't do that, you wouldn't really be putting the nature and quality of relationships, there wouldn't really be a primary report. And if you just let somebody leave without there being any kind of fanfare or any recognition at all, you can't possibly say that belonging is particularly important to your service. But you don't have to do that. We're not saying, what we want you to do is to demonstrate that that the nature and quality of relationships are important. We give you some ideas of how you might go about doing that. And but this is problematic because people want they see it as an absolute, right, we need them, you must be looking for something specific, but of course we're not. And, you know, the whole principle of enabling environments is based on the original NBQ, which I know has become synonymous with not very qualified, but the process of NBQ was a wonderful idea. The idea that people without qualifications could put together, you know, all of their learning in a kind of evidence, set of evidence, and potentially gain a recognition or a qualification that could be used in that way. And that's what we were doing with EE, is to say to people, look, we know that you know, if you are enabling, if you are, you know, ensuring that relationships are at the heart of your work, then just tell us how. Tell us how. And the assessors are trained to be able to come in and see whether or not that's the case. Of course, you need to tell us that, you know, how you've been doing that and how you are going to continue doing it in the future. But, you know, so it's not enough to sort of visit them and say, well, we're, you know, right now we're doing it. So that's why the portfolio is important. But I wouldn't say that it is a tick box. So that's the first part of my answer. But very briefly, the second part of my answer is that actually what we have found is that in services that are really struggling with some of these ideas, that if they do use it as a prescriptive, so if you put up, if you do something like setting a way of people leaving, you've never done it before, so you start doing it, it can actually then lead to you becoming enabling, you know, by the very nature of the fact that you are behaving differently and acting differently. So that's my answer. It's not a tick box, and yet, you know.
So it's kind of serving as a reminder of the sorts of values of things that should be important in a service which does prioritise community and belonging, it seems to be saying. And the final one from me, really, Sarah, is you referred earlier to, at the, I suppose, the birth of EE came amidst a time when there was a real threat to residential communities continuation. And I suppose, do you think EE has created enough protection for residential communities to continue, or do you see change there?
Well, I think that the protection of residential communities was sort of around the community of communities approach, perhaps, rather than the enabling environments. And the answer to that, unfortunately, is no. I don't think that there is one residential therapeutic community left within the NHS. I don't think anything we could have done would have made much of a difference to that. So I think that the idea of this work is challenging for services, and I think for mental health, for health services, national health services. And I think the key to this is we can see in children's work where independent practitioners set up or charities set up as therapeutic communities and get support from government in terms of placing and commissioning. So I think the way in which we think about communities and residential work needs to shift. But certainly in terms of enabling environments, I think people instinctively believe that EE is a good thing. I think our challenge is that we need the research. There is so much anecdotal evidence. There is so much we know about the benefits that developing as an enabling environment or the community of communities. But it's about how we provide evidence. And when we do provide evidence, that's acceptable evidence. So recently, an enormous piece of work was done on a random control trial for therapeutic community. And yet it was completely set aside because of some other, you know, confounding variable that it didn't meet, or it was challenged by somebody. I mean, and it will continue to be so. And the problem with this, and you're just getting my hobby horse here now, but the problem with this is you need money, and a lot of it, to do proper research, and the places that we're talking about don't have that kind of money. And so therefore it's not a level playing field. And so I think what we have to do is just do what we're doing. Somebody's already mentioned Roland Woodward's cultural creep terminology. And I think that's what we have to do. I think we have to continue to demonstrate that those services that are enabling have better outcomes in terms of whatever performance indicators that they choose to use. And we need to use the metrics and all that tick boxy stuff in order to support the work and show how we are different to those that are not doing it. And that is a challenge for somebody who's going to come after me. So, because I've yet to be able to manage to do that.
Thank you, Sarah.
Good. So in our podcast, we're very keen to identify things that really work, that do enhance wellbeing and creativity for staff and for residents. And I'm going to make this easy for you, Sarah. So I'm going to ask you for some examples and I'm going to give you some examples. So do TCs and enabling environments work? Yes, the answer. So for example, prison TCs now give reports, whereas 20 years ago, they hardly bothered and people would spend 4 years working in a prison TC and go away with five lines on a piece of paper, which they wouldn't even see. Yeah. And so that's a very tangible example. And secondly, I've got my own experience of visiting an approved premises twice, some year or 13 months apart, and I've seen a massive improvement. And that's all been through the engagement with the EE process. But can you think of some examples of your own?
Well, I suppose the one that really sticks out in my mind, and it just highlights the simplicity, which is the thing that I really want to sort of get across, is ordinariness and simplicity, is working with an approved premises that was really stuck. And certainly in terms of kind of including people and one thing and another. And we spent ages in a workshop sort of trying to get to the bottom of what was stuck. Why, he said, and eventually this person just said, if people would just say hello to one another in the mornings, that'd be something. So they get up and they just walk out the door. So we did this sort of small change, big impact type thing, and we did a sort of mini study, and I said to him, why don't you go away, I said, and just get people to say hello to people, just make it a rule that in the approved premises that people need to say good morning when they see you before they leave. So went away, I said, do it every day for 2 weeks, see how it goes. Anyway, in a 2 weeks time, we had a call and he said to me, I said, is it working? He said, is it hell? He said, no, it isn't at all. He said, they basically get up earlier and run out the door so that we don't say good morning to them anymore. I mean, because they just think it's a bit bonkers. And I said, well, are they saying good morning? Are you all doing it? It's like, oh, no, we're not expecting the prisoners to say good morning. I said, well, expect them to do it. When you set a rule, it's not about staff doing it to other people. It's about everyone doing it. So they set this rule. I rang up in 2 weeks' time and he said, I've never known anything like it. He said, suddenly people are sort of in the lounge. We started having croissants and cups of coffee. The men are sitting around. More men are actually then seeing people and involving in the activities that are taking place. Now, whether or not that led to any massive change in things, I suspect that it certainly had some impact. But it just goes to show that there are very, very simple things. People think it has to be complicated, but it doesn't. And yes, it makes a difference for those people to be able to sit and connect with others rather than spending all day sitting out in a park drinking Diamond White or whatever it was that they were doing. It has got to be better.
Fantastic example there of active learning and of course, hopefully, the staff weren't complained about for trafficking the croissant, which, of course, is a good example of needing all of the management and environment on side for these things. So, Sarah, I've known you for the whole of the time you've been the project leader at the Community of Communities, and since you were on the planning group was prior to that time. And I've always valued very highly your company in all kinds of ways. But what has kept you going, doing this? Well, we know it hasn't always been easy, so it's been a very demanding and frustrating job at times. So what keeps you going?
Pure bloody-mindedness, David, I think. I just think that it can be different, It's just a passion and a vision of how things, can be. And I just feel that there is I suppose it's what I've been saying all along, is that people think that we need to do some very complicated things. And I think that my view is that it's really people need to just get in touch with how they themselves want to be treated. I think every one of us knows what it's like to visit the GP and somebody doesn't say good morning to you, or you feel like they're not really listening to you. They're too busy looking at their emails to listen. Or even when you're during the COVID, we've all been on calls or having meetings and people are looking at emails rather than listening to what you're saying. These things that we do, these things create atmospheres and cultures that that make it difficult for people. And I think it's that really, it's that sense that one of the things that, the public sector especially live and dies on relational capital. People want to do their best, people care and they want to do the job. And then they were, as I said before, they didn't come into the job to fill out metrics, forms and all the rest of it. So I think it's really about trying to support the little guy, really, and that service users and the service user and the staff member are in it together. From my point of view, I've learned just as much from the people that I have nursed or cared or worked with, experts by experience, and to be open to the fact that that equal relationship can benefit both parties.
Great. So what's next for you?
I have no idea. So genuinely, I don't know. I think I reached a point this year where I realised that the programme manager role was distancing me from what really mattered and to me. And I suppose I would like to go into services more or sit alongside people who want to make these changes, but haven't had the benefit of the experience that I've had. And to help them to think about ways in which they can make a difference. And certainly at organisational level, what difference that a good leadership can make to a whole load of people. So I suppose some form of consultancy, some form of executive coaching, some form of leadership training, something like that, probably.
So have you got a website?
I don't at the moment, no. I don't have any at the moment. I can't even decide whether I'm going to be Sarah Padgett or Sarah Delafosse, because here I am in a Sarah. I mean, Sarah Delafosse is my married name, and I've always practiced under the name Sarah Padgett, and I've always thought I would be Sarah Delafosse, but now I don't know. So I need to decide what name I'm going to have before I get a website, I think. But I think I will be Sarah Padgett, and I would. Yes, if people want to get in touch with me, I'm on LinkedIn.
LinkedIn, good. So, thank you very much. That was terrific. Was there anything else you wanted to add, Naomi?
I just wanted to say thank you, Sarah. I really enjoyed that. And it was lovely to hear you talk with such passion about the importance of creating communities and also championing the ordinariness, which I think is really, really valuable, because that's something everyone could get on board with. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So we've got a bit of time for some questions. There aren't any questions. Well, Terry Wilson, you've made a number of comments. Is there anything you'd like to say?
Just fascinated to hear the whole story from Sarah. And I know the Richmond Fellowship and quite well. And it was just a comment really on. I always wondered where that went to, because there was a lot of that around in the 90s, and that was supported by local authorities under the previous system. And then as it all changed and the contract culture came in, it kind of seemed to disappear. And the Richmond Fellowship kind of shrunk down. And so all that wonderful kind of thinking and work, I just wondered where it went. And so it's great to hear that it's sort of the basis a bit of the environment. So it's amazing. Thank you.
What did happen to the Richmond Fellowship, Sarah?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure about the Richmond Fellowship. I know that the organisation that I joined was the Fellowship Charitable Foundation, which became Community Housing and Therapy. And Community Housing and Therapy is still running today and is still operating. I'm not sure about the Richmond Fellowship. I know Richmond Fellowship International is still running homes in Richmond, but on
Ellie Dance is still alive.
Yes, she said, I think
she is. Yeah.
And I get, and also I got to meet Maxwell Jones once as well. So that's interesting. Yeah, so he was obviously the founder. But yeah, because I got quite involved in all therapeutic communities in the 90s, and I ran. A sort of offending behaviour groups in one of the drug rehabs, which was quite new at that time, because no one else was doing it. So that was interesting, because I obviously had a connection with Crescent House in London. So
I think it's definitely, you know, about working with the client population in a very different way.
Yes, you know?
Very much with its roots in therapeutic communities and the
You're obviously making the environment work. So for me, new to this, because I'm new to this, actually. So I've been sort of saying, what is it? And I have found it difficult to get my head around it. But now I know where it comes from, it makes it easier for me to understand that it's hard to say what it's about. So, yeah, I can empathise with what you said on that, actually.
Don't we still have the Richmond Fellowship involved in therapeutic communities with Peel Tower?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's pockets of it around for sure, Simon. And of course, in Belfast, there is a very thriving communities threshold organisation, whose traditions are from the Richmond Fellowship.
So. I mean, just one of the other points I raised there was I think it was a bit about the how do you measure the progress on that, and I think that was one of the things that let the communities down previously, is it's hard to quantify, reduction in reoffending and stuff like that. And I still think that's going to be an issue moving forward. I think when they come to reevaluate it and see where they're spending the money, because it's about public money, and I think research is going to be key to keep it going, because I think as political will changes from time to time, and you know it could see if it doesn't evidence reduction in reoffending or personal development, then I think it'll come under pressure. Just an observation, really.
I suppose there is more and more evidence that just going to prison is damaging and traumatizing to people. So there's more and more evidence about the quality of the environment having a direct effect upon people.
Yes, I wish that there was an answer to this, but it's very, very difficult. The confounding variables alone, require study in and of itself. So because, one of the things with the therapeutic community research has always had criticism, because once it has been published, people start asking, well, which bit of the therapeutic community is the bit that creates the therapeutic change? Or is it the small groups, or, you know, is it the large group, or is it the, and, you know, there is a, it's very difficult to be able to be able to quantify the kind of the whole and the impact that the whole has.
And of course, that's where the piece of research you were referring to earlier fell down in the in the eyes of the evaluators, because they felt that it wasn't saying clearly enough that it was the small groups that made the difference, but that it was something intangible about the social environment.
Yes. You know? And equally, I mean, there's been research done in terms of enabling environments that, whilst not negative, isn't demonstrating any measurable change as such. But, you know, during the time in which that research study took place over a period of time, within approved premises, there has been huge changes across the probation service from the whole changing from the CSCs and the private, you know, the state probation service to private probation, and, you know, and so on and so forth. And you know, there's no recognition, like, for instance, you know, I suppose, like in mental health and generally, there's no recognition of the context within these things take place. So, you know, and the conditions politically and otherwise. I mean, if we think about, I think one of the things perhaps might be a way of ending, one of the things that we're very proud of is that we had an annual forum where Michael Spur spoke and talked about enabling environments as the shining light in the darkest period of history of criminal justice. And, you know, for us, that was an enormous driver to continue doing what we did. The sense that this is something that people can actually do. It doesn't cost anything. It doesn't cost anything to say hello to someone. It doesn't cost anything to say good morning or to actually listen when somebody is talking to you. And it doesn't, you know, I think it's really important to recognise that we all need compassionate environments.
Can I ask, I don't know how much longer we've got, but Sarah, I'm wondering whether, like me, after a number of years doing this, whether you go around in your outside world and evaluate the companies that you come into contact with, be they electrical, electric suppliers, water board, or supermarkets. Do you ever go around those and think, could this ever? Because I'm always doing it. It drives me mad.
I can't honestly say I do it all the time, so, but I have done it in hotels. And I did sort of was lying in a hotel in Rhodes once, thinking this would be a good new guidebook, you know, looking at whether or not a hotel is an enabling environment and giving them star ratings. You know, so you never know, that might be my new job.
Good idea. Yeah, that's a very good idea.
Thanks for that.
Okay, I think we've got to the end of our time. Thanks again, Sarah. Really. Enjoyed that, and pass over to Beth, Emily, and Tanita. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.